Good morning, members. I'm going to call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Election Committee to order pursuant to rule House Rule 10.01. The day is January 19th, 2021. And the committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
Here.
Vice Chair Carlson?
Present.
Representative Nash?
Present.
Representative Bonner?
Present.
Representative Drazkowski? Representative Elkins?
Present.
Representative Greenman?
Present.
Representative Cleghorn?
Cleghorn, present.
Representative Kosnick?
Kosnick, present.
Representative Mason?
Present.
Representative New Brindley? Representative Pulowski?
Present.
A quorum is present.
And make note that Representative Quam checked in. He has a bill up in capital investments. Great. Next order of business, approval of the minutes for January 14th, 2021. Representative Cleghorn, did you get a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, Chair Nelson, I move the minutes be adopted as written.
Motion is made to approve the minutes as written. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes have been passed. Members, the rules for the committee have been emailed to you and they were posted on the committee website. We do not need to vote on these, but they're here before the committee. If, like I said, hopefully we can adhere to these. And I said the 24-hour rule and that on the amendments as much as possible so that we can get them posted for the public. But we can move on and be flexible if we have to in the future. And with that, I want to welcome Attorney General Keith Ellison to the committee. Good morning, Attorney General.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
And you have a presentation of a combination of an overview, a slight overview, and your budget recommendations.
That's right. And I will begin with a budget overview. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ranking Member Nash and all members for having me here. I'd like to also share with you, I have with me today Mr. Ray Smith, who is the head of our finance group, and Eric Miller, who is the head of our electronic law group, who handles mostly discovery issues, but given the vast amount of documents we have to process, we really rely on his services. He's available and can respond to questions as they arise. Again, thank you so much for having me. The Attorney General's office and all 325 members of that office definitely appreciate this committee's time. Just an overview about the Attorney General. The Minnesota Constitution established the Office of Attorney General to serve as the state's chief legal officer. Every state has an Attorney General. 43 states, including Minnesota, have elected attorneys general, and 48 states have attorneys general that serve the people and have what they call common law parents patriot authority to take legal action on behalf of the state. Only two states mirror the federal system where the chief executive appoints the attorney general. The states have opted to have split executive, if you will, and the attorney general in Minnesota and 43 other states operates on at the pleasure of the voter. The role of and duties of the Attorney General arise from the Minnesota Constitution, state statutes, cases, particularly Chapter 8 defines the Attorney General's duties and responsibilities. The Attorney General has three main duties and several other important ancillary duties. Those ancillary duties include the Board of Pardons, State Board of Investment, the Executive Council, and a few others. But the main part of the work I do every day and our office does every day is to represent the state agencies, boards, and commissions. There are over 100 of them. It's our job to represent them. Our relationship to them is attorney-client. They make the decisions. We do the legal work. The second main duty of the Attorney General's office is to protect the people of the state of Minnesota by bringing lawsuits on behalf of Minnesota residents. As the chief enforcer of the state's consumer protection, antitrust, and charities laws, in Minnesota statute section 8.31, the legislature directed the Attorney General to investigate and prosecute violations of law of this state respecting unfair, discriminatory, or other unlawful practices in business, commerce, or trade. That's Minnesota section 8.31. Three, the third main thing we do, and the bulk of my time is spent supporting county attorneys, local authorities, especially from smaller counties in criminal justice related matters. We there's of the 87 counties in Minnesota, I'd say about 79 of them to 80 of them would call us if they had a murder or a serious crime. We consider that support role very critical. The Attorney General cannot initiate a criminal prosecution on its own. We have to be brought in by the county attorneys or appointed by the governor, but it's common that we get called upon in district court matters and in appellate ones as well. Let me share with you a little bit about how the Attorney General's office is organized. The Attorney General currently is made of about 325 hardworking employees. About 40% of them are lawyers. The remainder are legal assistants, including investigators, consumer assistance group, mediators, financial analysts, economists, one or two economists, and support staff. The office consists of four large legal sections. Four different sections were divided into. Each one is led by a deputy attorney general or the solicitor. There's only one solicitor. So three deputies and the solicitor, who's equivalent to a deputy. The first one is consumer protection. It's led by James Cannaday, extremely able leader. Health and safety, that is led by David Voigt, who is a very strong deputy. Government support by Luz Maria Frias and the Solicitor General Liz Kramer. Each section has divisions underneath it, organized around subject matter and client agencies. Because we have limited time today, I won't go into the further organization of the office, but I'm happy to refer you to our annual report as required under Minnesota Statute 8.15, and that's filed in the Legislative Reference Library, and it outlines much of the work we've done over the past year. I'm proud of the report, and I encourage you to read it. Let me talk to you about what the Attorney General's office brings to the state of Minnesota and the people of Minnesota. We bring a lot of things, including monetary value. Usually the office is a net contributor to the state. In recent years, the office has saved the state or returned to state coffers millions of dollars. In 2018 alone, six large settlements brought in over $100 million to the state of Minnesota. So far in fiscal year 21, we've deposited about $5 million into the state's general fund. The Office of Attorney General also puts dollars directly back into the pockets of your constituents, including people and businesses. Last year, our Consumer Action Division obtained over $5 million for Minnesota consumers. That's businesses and people. These are your constituents, and they often, very often, they've been preyed upon by fraudsters. It's our job to protect them from those fraudsters, and our folks do a good job. Let me talk to you about budget. For three biennia before the current one, the total general fund appropriation for the Attorney General's office was frozen at $2.2.125 million. The general fund appropriation to the Attorney General's office in 2018 was the same as what it was in 2004. And 20% lower than what it was in 2002. And so for the current biennium beginning in July 1, 2019, the Attorney General's office received its first real dollar increase in 6 years, bringing our general fund appropriation to $23.513 million, $23.5 million. Here's what we spend our money on. It's very straightforward. More than 80% of our appropriations go to salary and benefits that support our employees, with the rest going toward administrative expenses. We do have change items we would like to put in front of you. Mr. Chairman and members, I'd now like to draw attention to our change item requests for your consideration. Therefore, and I'll share them with you. The first one is investments in technology. All of our change item requests are urgent. This one is the most urgent. Investments in recruitment and retention. I'll explain that more. We've got to have a top staff to meet the needs of the people of the state of Minnesota. Investments in antitrust. This is meeting the changing market and the high concentration of nearly every American economic industry and the need for greater competition. And that is something that we are charged to do, but we're underfunded to do. Investments in criminal enforcement. As I noted earlier, we definitely need to be there for all of the smaller counties in our state, which is a greater majority, about more than 79 of them. Let me begin talking about investments in technology. I'm not an expert. Eric Miller is, and he's here for your questions. But first, let me just go over a few things. First, the Attorney General's Office requests resources to make investments in technology that are critical to running a modern law office. When I started practicing law, you could just type up your papers, go down, have them stamped at the court office, and file them. Nowadays, e-filing is how ordinary business is done. The change item for investments in technology has four parts. First, expanding e-discovery. So when we're suing, for example, Purdue or the Sacklers or any huge company, we often will get tons of documents, nearly impossible just to catalog and know every single document, every single thing in there. E-discovery allows us to manage that large database. The other part of the technology request is purchase of a centralized case management system. Third update to our consumer complaint database. We get complaints from all over the state. We need to be able to disaggregate the data. We also need to be able to use that data to trend spot. And then lastly, but certainly just as important as the other ones, is to develop an online charity registration database. We already have one. It's deeply antiquated. Let me turn now to e-discovery. The Attorney General currently uses electronic discovery or e-discovery software to manage ever expanding a number of electronic documents that are the center of complex litigation that the Attorney General handles on behalf of the state agencies and people of the state. The Attorney General currently has more than 60 matters that have more than 50,000 documents. I didn't say 50,000 pages, 50,000 separate documents, some of which are quite voluminous individually, with the largest case having about 5.9 million documents. These tools help our staff search, organize, and locate key documents that help prove our case and allow us to defend lawsuits against state agencies. E-discovery tools allow the Attorney General to take on cases that we may not otherwise be able to. E-discovery technology is essential in the successful resolution for Minnesota consumers, for cases against CenturyLink, Comcast, Insys Therapeutics. You know, that's a case involving antitrust violations involving insulin. The Minnesota School of Business, Globe University, big volume documentation, and it's also proven essential in our Medicaid fraud control unit that recovers costs for the state. That unit is essential to making sure the Medicaid program is viewed as a good program, a program of integrity. Our lawyers take people to task who abuse that program, but we need to be able to operate the program with available technology. E-discovery tools are not available to state agencies through Minute. So the state agencies represent we represent either rely on the Attorney General or outside vendors to do it. We have resisted charging state agency clients for the cost of hosting their data and the staff costs involved. But there have been and there are explosive growth in data being sent to the AGL. And that has led to explosive costs. And the AGL has borne that for the state agencies. We need some help with this. Next, let me talk about our, as part of our upgraded technology request, where our improvements to our case management system, including cloud backup and disaster recovery. After years of underinvestment, the office's internally built case management system is simply antiquated. It does not provide the functionality we need to efficiently manage and report on the thousands of documents that are open at any given time. As I said, the volume of data we manage also continues to grow exponentially. Our intention is to purchase a case management system that is specifically designed for managing the approximately 2,500 legal matters initiated each year. We also intend to shift to cloud-based storage that will allow us to house tens of millions of documents we manage across cases and maintain appropriate backup and disaster recovery in the event of a failure or other catastrophic events. Additionally, as part of our needed IT upgrades, includes the charities database. This is particularly important. Minnesota law mandates that the Minnesota Attorney General's Office maintain a registry of soliciting charitable organizations, professional fundraisers, and charitable trusts that meet certain statutory requirements. There are currently more than 13,000 soliciting charitable organizations, nearly 3,000 charitable trusts, and more than 400 professional fundraisers with registered with our office. The current system was implemented over 20 years ago, two decades. It's not paper, it is a paper-based system. It's a paper-based system, and registrants must complete a mail paper registration documents and checks to our office. Staff must then manually input the data into the database, which now has a significant number of bugs and errors. Some of these errors impact the ability of our office to fulfill its statutory duty. A new online charity registration system will not only improve our ability to fulfill those duties and prevent and enforcement and violations of charities law, it'll provide the public with more transparency about how charities in Minnesota raise and spend money that Minnesotans contribute. The last item on our IT request is an updated consumer complaint system. The Consumer Action Division directly assists consumers, businesses, and other organizations in obtaining settlements with third parties. Through its efforts, the division often eliminates the need for costly, time-consuming litigation. It also helps consumers informally resolve complaints with businesses. The division received more than 17,000 complaints, but we got more than 85,000 calls last year. 17,000 actual actionable complaints, but a lot of call volume. And we saved or returned more than $5 million directly to the public. So that is an important value. Like the charities database, the consumer complaint database was implemented over 20 years ago. The database holds a few hundred thousand complaints, originally a paper-based database. It is slightly modified last year to allow for online submissions. However, the online form is not linked to the database. Complaints submitted online must be entered by hand. Then a new consumer complaints database will allow staff to serve Minnesotans far more efficiently and more quickly. We also propose to change the technology underlying the database to allow people to track status of their own complaints, which they cannot do now. It will also allow us to identify trends in the complaint data, which often serve as a basis for investigations that protect Minnesotans from fraud and abuse. Again, those are the four parts of our first overall change request for investments in technology. Joining me today again is Eric Miller, manager of our eDiscovery unit, and he's available to answer any detailed questions you may have about this request. As I noted, I'm not the expert, Eric is, and feel free to ask him questions at the right time. The next item I'd like to address is recruitment and retention. Our second of four change items is for recruitment and retention of attorneys and support staff. The Attorney General's Office is the law office for the people of the state of Minnesota. Few law offices in Minnesota handle the range and complexity of civil litigation as the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Our clients include more than 100 state agencies, boards and commissions, as well as the people of the state of Minnesota. We handle more than 7,000 legal files every year. Recruiting and retaining an expert workforce is not only essential for the AGO to fulfill its duty to the state and serve and protect Minnesotans, but it is also cost efficient. If the state contracted out for the same services as the AGO provides, the cost would be enormous, way more than you spend now, and the quality would not be nearly as good. Our lawyers, when they're allowed to stick around for a while, when they're able to stay in the office because they're being compensated fairly, develop expertise and institutional memory, and it helps them become good at what they do. I talked about the impact of long-term disinvestment in AGO and technology. Another significant impact is that our attorneys earn less than public attorneys for local metro counties. And almost a third less than the U.S. Attorney's Office. This gap in earnings can make it very challenging for us to recruit public interest-minded lawyers. And when we are able to recruit them, the gap can make it hard to retain them. Sometimes our attorneys leave us for these other public law offices because they can earn more money for their families there and still serve the public. When they do, their knowledge and expertise leaves with them, and that hurts the people in the state of Minnesota. And I'm talking about Ramsey County, Hennepin County, other public law offices, great people who do great work. But our folks should not be, the AGO should not be a training ground for those in agencies. We should compensate our people fairly. And I ask you to help me do this. The small increase we seek this year is the difference between our original request to the legislature in 2019 and what we're being appropriated during the 2019 special session. So, it's really not a brand new thing. It's just trying to make up for what we project as our needs from the last biennium. Let me just talk about antitrust enforcement. Our third of the four change items is investment in antitrust enforcement to protect competition in our state. Antitrust laws are a critical piece of Minnesota's consumer protection framework. Antitrust laws are designed to protect competition, allowing the marketplace to deliver superior goods and services to consumers at a higher quality and a lower price than the market would without competition. Competition also provides an incentive to businesses to be more efficient, to have better customer service, which helps them to survive. Efficiency helps businesses survive in a transnational economy. But when there is no competition, that incentive isn't there. That's when we come in to enforce the antitrust laws. It's not fair to the vast majority of Minnesota businesses who play by the rules to be undercut by illegal anti-competitive antitrust behavior by a few, often very large bad actors, and it also harms Minnesota consumers. The Attorney General's Office has actively investigated or brought litigation against antitrust behavior in two areas. One is the pharmaceutical industry, including the prices of generic drugs and insulin. The other is in agriculture, where we continue to focus on issues of importance to farmers and rural communities. Although I cannot reveal the details of our investigations, they involve aspects of livestock industry and other agricultural products of importance to Minnesota. And certain where practices of some corporate actors are hurting our farmers and diminishing and shrinking the size of the small farm community. Let me note that since 2017, we've lost about 810 dairy farms in Minnesota. That's because large actors in the field, engaging in anti-competitive pricing and forcing smaller operators to sell or to go out of business. This is a shame. Antitrust law enforcement helps us maintain levels of competition, as well as family farms and small businesses. Funding this request will not only increase capacity of the office to protect consumers and meet its duty to enforce Minnesota antitrust laws, it would have an impact on recovery of damages and civil penalties by the state. Lastly, let me go to criminal enforcement. This is, again, something we've been talking about all along. The last of our four change requests is for investment in criminal enforcement by helping Greater Minnesota County Attorneys prosecute criminal behavior and other crimes that unfairly harm consumers and businesses. Under Minnesota Statute 8.01, a county attorney may request the attorney general to prosecute a case for it. We try to never turn them down, and if we do, it's only because of capacity. I hate to have to say we would help you, but we don't have the people. But that has happened. Under previous administrations, the AGO significantly reduced legal services available to respond to these requests. Due to this reduction, the AGO has not had the capacity to fully lend support in prosecuting violent and complex crimes. High-impact white-collar crimes or cross-country crimes such as sex trafficking and financial exploitation. With additional resources, we will gradually rebuild the office's capacity to aid counties to enforce the criminal laws in their jurisdiction that are beyond the scope of normal resources and aid enforcement of the criminal laws of the state. In addition, we will build the capacity to prosecute crimes that hurt Minnesotans' economic security. More resources will also allow our people to provide county attorneys with more help with appeals. I'm pleased to inform you in your packets, and you will find a better letter. You will find a letter of support of our budget request from Bob Small, who is the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. And just to let you know, without any changes in our budget for this particular unit, we have increased the number of criminal prosecutors in our office on our own because we see it as an urgent need. But that has come at the expense of other things. We just feel we had to do it. But with a little extra assistance, we could really meet the needs of the state. So let me close by saying thank you for your time and attention. Again, I'm joined by Ray Smith, who is also available to answer questions, as well as Eric Miller. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much. I'll yield back.
Thank you, Attorney General. I also just make note here that Representative Ruskowski and Representative New Brindley have joined us. I have questions here. If you want to ask a question, click on the raise your hand function in the Zoom. The first person I have on my list is Representative Claiborne. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Attorney General Ellison. My question to you is there anything that you can publicly share with us about the status of the opioid litigation and how much you estimate revenue would be returned to our state from that important work that you're doing?
Attorney General.
Yeah, actually, thank you for asking that, Representative. Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are some things I can share. Right now, the case involving the Sackler family in Purdue Pharma has been stayed because of the bankruptcy. That bankruptcy has put us in a position where we are still trying to negotiate settlement, but we continue to be in a form of stasis because of the bankruptcy. Our litigation against Purdue Pharma is, however, ongoing, and we continue to try to resolve that case. No plan has been reached so far. We don't have a settlement, so I can't speculate as to the dollar amount. Settlement negotiations are ongoing with other companies, though. It's not only the Sacklers, including the opioid manufacturers and distributors. In fact, four companies, Johnson & Johnson, McKesson, Cardinal, and AmerisourceBergen, have agreed in principle to a $26 billion settlement with states and local governments. While Minnesota's share is not yet clear, is not yet known, I suspect it'll be between 1% to 2%. We are hopeful that Minnesota will recover tens of and possibly hundreds of millions of dollars. Again, not sure what that amount is going to be. But I expect it to be very substantial. We intend that every dollar recovered by the state go into the opioid epidemic response account to be used for purposes of abatement of opioid crisis statewide. And I would stress the last point, that unlike typical litigation recoveries, the law that the legislature passed requires that monies from opioid litigation and settlement go directly to opioid epidemic response. And that's because of the important work the legislature did to make sure that families and communities have their problems addressed as a result of the opioid crisis.
Thank you. Representative Claiborne, follow up. I see your shaking head. Representative Carlson is the next on my list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney General Ellison, thank you for being with us today. Appreciate your opening remarks. Your agency clearly punches above its weight when it comes to the workload that you guys have upon you, especially during the pandemic. Working with the governor's executive orders. In light of all these new challenges that your agency is tasked with, can you maybe just summarize for us once again, kind of put in perspective approximately how many of these lawsuits challenging the governor's executive orders you have to defend?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, let me just start by saying that there are over 10,000 restaurants and 1,500 bars in Minnesota. Overwhelmingly, they have complied with the COVID restrictions. We have had to field questions and be in conversation with about 900 institutions, but we've only had to sue about 12. We don't just go straight to lawsuit. What we do is we talk with people, we negotiate, we share with information with them, we try to make it clear with them, we listen to them about what the problems that they're facing are. We share those back with the people who draft the executive orders. But when you have open defiance and people saying they're just not going to abide by the law, we have had to go to court. And we haven't lost a single case yet. But let me be clear about how litigation works. The Attorney General's office has no authority to fine anyone or punish anyone. What we can do is bring a case, and the court makes the decision about whether or not there's sufficient factual basis that this entity violated the law and the executive order is the law. And then the courts will assess fines, order disgorgement, and will, in some cases, order attorney's fees. But this is after a lot of conversation, so it's something that we don't like to do, and we tell them that we would rather have voluntary compliance. And thankfully, overwhelmingly, Minnesota institutions have put their employees and their customers first and done the best they could, even despite the difficult situation everyone's in.
Thank you, Attorney General. Appreciate it.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney General, thank you for the briefing you gave me the other day. And I will ask you the same question that I asked you then. What are the fixed dollar amounts that you're asking? What is the percentage of budget increase? And then the question that I asked you the other day that I think the people who are watching this committee will find value in is, many people around the state right now are experiencing a constriction of their budget. Businesses are closing through no fault of their own. Families are experiencing financial distress. Folks are tightening their belt around the state, and I'm just wondering, what is your plan to do the job with a base budget or perhaps less? Because depending on what our fiscal forecast is going to look like, we're going to all have to tighten our belt. And I certainly understand the technology requests and look forward to your technologist sharing some of what that is. But first question is, how are you going to do more with less?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member Nash, you know, one of the interesting things about our office is that when people are in economic distress, we get more calls. We're counter-cyclical in that way. For example, we've had to enforce the eviction moratorium. You can hardly shelter in place if you have no shelter. And so, you know, when folks have been faced with being thrown into the street, It's been our legal obligation to call and inform landlords that they really can't do that, except for under certain conditions. But you see, my point is, we are a counter-cyclical operation. So when people are being defrauded, I mean, I would simply submit to the committee that when people are being defrauded, when people are being evicted, when people are being the victims of wage theft, cutting the people whose job it is to protect them in that moment is eating your seed corn. And I would submit that I would ask to respectfully ask the committee to consider that. Cutting off the resources that help people when they're in most economic peril leaves them in even greater economic peril. So to prevent the hardship, there's got to be a strong AG presence to keep people afloat. With that, Representative Nash, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask for a little help from my friend Ray Smith, who's head of finance.
And Mr. Chair, before we cut away, Attorney General Olson, could you answer the first part of the question as to what is the monetary value and growth percentage ask for your budget before we move on to the tech piece?
Well, actually, Representative Nash, Mr. Ray Smith is my finance director, and I told him that I would like him to join to help with just those kind of questions. So if it's okay with you, Representative Mr. Smith.
Mr. Smith, if you want to state your name for the record and then proceed to answer the question.
Thank you, Attorney Nelson. Ray Smith, Director of Finance at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Representative Nash, I'll start with the two change items that the committee has seen before in the prior biennium. The assistance to rural county attorneys is a request for $1.8 million, which represents approximately an 8% increase in our base budget. The remaining amount for retaining Attorney General staff of $300,000 represents a 1% increase in our base. The new items, the information technology change items, is a little more complex in that about half of it is one-time money and half of it is an ongoing increase to our base of $1.68 million. That represents a 7% increase. And then the antitrust area, $578,000, that represents a 2.5% increase approximately.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you detail again the employee retention dollars, if you would, please?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash. So in the last biennium, we were awarded additional money to help narrow the gap between ourselves and other public law offices. That change item was not fully funded. And so this request is to get the $300,000 that was not funded in the last biennium.
Representative Nash.
Okay. If you would, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, move on to the tech upgrades, what they are, what they do, and the costs that we're looking at again.
And members, just remember that the secretary or the attorney general needs to leave around 9:15, 9:20-ish. So if we can shorten the questions and move on. But Representative Nash, I think Mr. Smith, if you want to answer that question.
Maybe Mr. Miller might be better for breaking down the IT requests by unit.
Mr. Miller, again, if you want to identify yourself for the record and proceed with to answer the question.
Yes, thank you. Eric Miller, e-discovery manager at the Attorney General's office. I'll also start my video here. The technology proposals, the first one is increased capacity subscription-based service for our e-discovery tools, which the Attorney General mentioned. The other three projects are what I would categorize as legacy system upgrades. So these are SQL backend databases, which is certainly a technology that still exists today. However, the user interface and programming code is actually built in Microsoft Access. A lot of people don't program in that using VBA code anymore. It's not a, I see a number of heads shaking, as a number of members on this committee have technology backgrounds. So you kind of understand the vernacular that I'm using here. The current technology does not blend well with having responsive web integrated applications, mobile devices, really allowing members of the public to engage with our office utilizing technology that's currently available. Again, the charities database, the consumer complaint database, and the case management are all internally built systems utilizing Microsoft Access. I would note that I spent the weekend reviewing the Blue Ribbon Council on Information Technology report that was put out in June 2020, of which a few members of this committee are part of. And I was pleased to see that our process for evaluating these products were actually utilized, this whole notion of build versus buy. And, you know, 20 years ago, it made sense to build these custom applications in-house. Over time, with advances in cybersecurity, technology, privacy, it probably makes more sense now to find a product off the shelf that we can get long-term support for, rely on a vendor to maintain. And so I'm really utilizing the framework that was outlined in that Blue Ribbon Council as sort of a guiding principles, if you will, for these technology products.
Representative Nash, last question.
I'll be quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that we will have a briefing on some of the technology stuff afterwards. But, I guess to end my time again, the AG has certainly made a lot of headlines lately and seems to be staffed well enough to do some of those issues. I will posit again that we need to be looking at ways to tighten a belt. And I certainly understand that you're doing your level best and that there are technology acquisition issues that have to be addressed. But again, I'm going to beat this drum every day that we see a budget request, Mr. Chair. This is not the land of milk and honey. This is not the same budget that we had at the beginning of the last biennium. And this is something that we have to know that the people of Minnesota are looking at us to get done, which is to be responsible and not just look at every request as something that is vitally important that we have to come up with money for, because the only place that we come up with money is the taxpayer's checkbook. So with that, I'll be done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next on my list is Representative Ruskowski. Welcome to, if you want to ask your question. You need to unmute yourself, Steve. Representative Skowski, you need to unmute yourself.
There he goes.
There you go. Go ahead and ask your question, Representative Skowski.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I have the mute off when I was talking to someone here? I apologize. Thank you.
I thought you were asking a question. I saw your mouth moving, and I thought you were asking a question. So.
No, it was a business deal on my phone that I was trying to get squared away. So thank you, Mr. Chair. So thank you, Attorney General Ellis. And Attorney General, we have a constitution that outlines very clearly the powers of government. Article 3 talks about the separation of powers, and Articles 4, 5, and 6 talk about those three branches and their responsibilities. One of them in the legislative branch, as you know, is to provide for oversight and certainly protection and be aware of the encroachments upon its powers as prescribed in the Constitution. You talked earlier about the governor's executive orders, and I think we need to acknowledge the fact that the separation of powers and whether or not Section 12.31 is actually constitutional, is very much in dispute, and that court case continues forward, and at some place will be decided upon. So there's a lot of people that believe that what the governor is doing is not according to our Constitution. With that in mind, and one thing you said to me was kind of, and I think I heard you or maybe the governor, both of you say it before in the executive branch, saying that the executive orders are law. My question to you is, do you really believe that those executive orders are law when the legislative branch is the branch that is charged with writing laws in our state? Or was that simply an inaccuracy in your rhetoric?
Attorney General.
No, according to Minnesota statutes, which were promulgated by the legislature, in times of civil emergency, civil unrest, the governor does have the authority to issue executive orders, which must be approved within a certain fixed amount of time by the executive council. And that matter has to be put in front of the legislature, and the legislature can overturn those if it sees to do so. And so, yes, sir, I do believe that the executive orders issued by the governor are factually supported by an emergency, which this pandemic certainly is. We've had over nearly 400,000 Americans dead, thousands of Minnesotans lost their lives, and literally millions have been infected. And in fact, now we're seeing greater and more virulent strains. So that is clearly an emergency in my mind. So I think that every court that we've gone in front of has vindicated the governor's authority to issue executive orders, courts of competent jurisdiction in the state of Minnesota. And of course, we'll see what happens in the next cases. But fact of the matter is, so far, it's very clear that the governor is acting constitutionally.
Representative Dzikowski. And Representative Dzikowski, you talk about the lawsuits. If they come down and they rule opposite, then we'll have to make changes. And I know Representative Pawlowski's committee is looking at all those and going to take a deep in-depth look at all those issues in Chapter 12. Representative Dzikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're very aware of Representative Pawlowski and his committee's activity. Thank you, Attorney General Ellison.
Thank you, sir.
So what I heard from you is you believe that those executive orders actually comprise law.
Yes. That is accurate.
One more question, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Representative Dzikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Attorney General Ellison. The amount of corruption and ineptitude in our government is well documented. Chapter 8 directs the activities of your office, and you've been very involved in your office in suing businesses throughout our state. I haven't seen your agency involved in holding governments accountable when they step outside the law. Can you tell me whether you believe Chapter 8 or your duties include holding state and local units of government accountable when they violate the law?
Attorney General Ellison.
Mr. Chairman, Minnesota Statute 8.31 authorizes the state Attorney General to carry out enforcement action when it's unfair discriminatory practice in the areas of business, commerce, or trade. I don't think that there's any unit of government that would be exempt if they were engaging in unfair discriminatory illegal behavior, if they were involved in the practice of business, commerce, or trade. But it is our job to represent the state agencies, so you can hardly sue your own client, which is what we would be doing if we were to sue state units of government. So I suppose there is a scenario under if some city was selling some product or service and was defrauding people, I don't see anything in Minnesota law that says we couldn't hold them accountable. But the statute promulgated by the legislature, signed by the governor many years ago, 8.31, really contemplates that we protect consumers in the area of business, commerce, or trade. So I do thank you for your question.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And the last question I have here, because the Attorney General has to leave, is Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Attorney General Ellison. And I think getting to that question, you know, you brought up the countercyclical nature of your office, and also in times like these public health emergencies, the work that you're doing. I'm interested in, when we talk about fraud, if you can talk at all about the work you've been doing to fight medical fraud, given and fraud, given we have a COVID-19 crisis and we always see additional threats to consumers, I'd say, when we have times of crisis. If you could speak a little bit about that.
Attorney General.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Greenman, thank you for that question, because the truth is we've been extremely busy in this area. You know, the fact is that there have been, in, right when the pandemic began, there are a number of establishments out there that were saying that they had a miracle cure or a miracle test or a miracle this or a miracle that. We engaged with them and required that they cease and desist that false and deceitful sort of advertising. We then moved on and are involved in litigation with a number of pharmaceutical companies, all which have COVID implications, because if you are a type 2 diabetic and you can't afford your insulin, imagine how much more vulnerable you are with a lethal virus spreading throughout the country. It's much more difficult. So we've been extra diligent in that area as well. Also, the Minnesota Attorney General's office has a history of working on medical billing and making sure that aggressive, strong-arm tactics to try to get medical bills, old medical bills paid up, that at least the institutions abide by proper bill collecting practices, and some of them have not always done that. And then in our role as representatives of the state government, we have, and in the area of charities as well, we have been in ongoing dialogues with hospitals to talk about how are you meeting the needs for PPE for employees? How are you meeting the needs of underserved communities, particularly when service needs are so high right now? It's been a very, very busy area for us, and I think and I thank you for asking the question.
Representative Greenman, last question, or is that just a quick one?
Yeah, I would just say thank you for that. My sister is a nurse practitioner, and I know that she's been seeing some of that, particularly for her most vulnerable clients in long-term care facilities. So I just really appreciate the work that the Attorney General's doing, your whole office is doing to protect Minnesotans.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Greenman.
And Attorney General Ellison, thank you for showing up today. And I know you have to leave to get to another meeting. Thank you for your time. And I'm sorry for the members that we weren't able to get to everybody's questions, but hopefully when at a later date, if we have specific issues before us, we can get other questions asked, or you can submit your questions to the Attorney General's office. But thank you, Attorney General.
Mr. Chairman, may I just say thank you to you and Ranking Member Nash and everybody on the committee. And if anyone still wants to ask me a question, I'm very accessible. You can even call me, and I'll be more than happy to talk about it. So thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. And members, now we're waiting for the Secretary of State is supposed to be coming, and supposed to be here at 9:30. So let's take a short recess, and we will, when the Secretary of State gets here, we can proceed with his presentation and his budget requests and answer questions. Members, call this meeting of the State Government Finance Committee back to order. We have, I see on the list, I don't see Secretary Simon yet, but we have Sam Bonowitz, B.B. Black, and Julie Struthers from the Secretary of State's office. Ms. Bonowitz is the secretary here, or going to be here quickly?
I am checking with him now. He should be getting on pretty quickly here.
Okay. While we're waiting for him, we have one other small piece of business that we need to do, is just to make note of, we have one bill that came to us that we need to refer down to local government division. We don't need to take action on it, but House File 35 is being, by memo, being sent down to the local government division or subcommittee for their consideration. And I see Representative Quam has rejoined us. Welcome back, Representative Quam. I hope your bill went well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it appeared to be successful. No arrows were tossed at it. But we all know technical correction bills usually are pretty easy. Thank you.
Chair Nelson, this is Sam Bonowitz. Secretary Simon will be signing on right now.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Secretary Simon. If you want to introduce yourself for the record, whenever you're ready, go on with your presentation. You're muted, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If I seem a little out of breath, it's because today is the first day back in school for second grade. So I just drove a second grader to school. I knew it would be a close call to get here by 9:30. I think I'm only a minute late. So thank you for your indulgence. I really appreciate it. Let me just, if I can, share.
And please introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry, members.
That's okay.
Mr. Chair, Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I just sat down. So please, thanks for your indulgence here. Let me just share. Okay. Hold on. Here we go. Okay. Can everyone see that?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I really appreciate your time and attention. It's an honor to be with you today, as it is always. I note that this committee, maybe others have noted it before me, has an expanded footprint, expanded jurisdiction. So it's got more stuff to do, more stuff in it, yet fewer members than it did in prior sessions. So I appreciate that. I appreciate the workload that all of you are experiencing with this and your other committee assignments. So thank you for that. It'll be an interesting ride. I served on this committee during, I think, almost all, perhaps all of my 10 years in the legislature. So I know what you've got before you, and I think it's an exciting overview of state government that you have before you. Just before I go on to the particulars, members, I wanted to note, as I try always to do, this is not a one-off. I'm not just here to appear before you and then sort of disappear into the wind. If you ever, as individuals, have anything you want to know about from me, from our staff, Sam Bonowitz, our director of Government Affairs, is on this call or at this meeting. She's available to you all the time. I'm available to you. So please reach out if you want a personal or private or separate briefing, or you have a question, or you want some stats or anything like that. This is not a one and done. I hope you know that. This is for the benefit of all of you and for the benefit of the public as well.
Secretary Simon, I just want to say one thing.
Yep.
We have, as we've been informed, that we have to be out on
okay.
time in our committees because of the technical piece of the
sure.
of it. So if we can
yep. Yep.
get this done quickly, and we got a few, already got three people with their hands
yep.
up. With
questions. Will do, will do. So the one thing I always start with as well, members, is to always make clear that we are a small profit center for the state. Unlike most of the agencies or organizations that will be before you, we make money for the state. We make a lot more than we cost, as I'll detail a little bit later. So the first slide I wanted to just talk about Okay, first slide is an overview of how we divide up the office. Most people, when they think of the office, as you can imagine, think of us as the elections people. And I understand that. That's what gets the most attention, the most interest, the most scrutiny, especially during election time. But as you can see, a large majority of our office is not in elections. Most of what we do is in the business services section of our office, a large percentage. And they really take up the bulk of our work. It's not noted in the slide, but I'm sure it might be a question of yours. What about FTEs? The FTE count right now is 96. We've got 96 FTEs in the office. That is down from a high of 112 in the year 2004 and a more recent near high of 111 in 2011. So we're down. And some of you may remember from 2 years ago, I said this and it remains true, Our Chief of Staff, Julie Strother, did a deep dive a little bit ago into our budgets historically over the last almost 30 years into the early 90s. And she came up with a phrase that I think describes our growth and size over time. She said it was aggressively flat. And I think that's right. We are not an example where we're growing by leaps and bounds and we're doing all this new stuff and we're, you know, out of control growth. That's not us. Historically, regardless of who's secretary, it's been pretty steady and pretty stable in terms of FTEs and footprint. Next slide. Let's talk about business services, because that is really the biggest part of the office. We like to describe ourselves as the welcome mat of the office because, as many of you know from personal experience, the very first thing you'll often do when you start a business is not get a tax ID number, not get a license or permit, not get insurance. It's file the entity. What are you? Are you ABC Inc. or XYZ company or whatever? You've got to do that first before you can get any of those other things. So that's why I say we're the welcome mat. We improve and file articles of incorporations, business name filings, amendments for all businesses and nonprofits of the state, several hundred thousand, as you'll see in a moment. Pardon me, folks. Okay. So, okay. Sorry, folks, just a little technological issue here. Okay, so let's talk about the UCC division, Uniform Commercial Code, which is in place in almost every state in the country. This is really a major catalyst for economic activity in the state. The reason is, as many of you know from personal experience, this has to do with filings for all collateral pledge to secure loans, period, across the state. So this is the grease that makes the machine go. And so we handle all of that. So administer the CNS system, Central Notification System. Many of you who are familiar with the rural economy know that you've been to a grain elevator. This is a key part of those transactions. So we work a lot with farm groups, ag groups, co-ops, and the like on that as well. And we also file and maintain state and federal tax liens too. So here's just an overview of the level of activity. In the numbers, you can see that in fiscal year 19, which ended this last summer, we continue to break records in our office with more and more people engaging in Minnesota's business community. So far for fiscal year 2020, filings are up. They're up in some categories substantially, and that might seem counterintuitive, and I can understand why. We're in a time of COVID with decreased economic activity, but we are seeing what we think is a repeat of the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009, where there was also a spike in business filings. Why? Because, at least it appears that way now, people get laid off from a company and they strike out on their own. They hang out their own shingle, they start that business in their home, and we think that's a lot of what's going on here. So another service that we provide that's fairly new, that provides and will continue to provide revenue for the state, we don't keep any of it, it all goes to the general fund, is something we call the Minnesota Business Snapshot. It's basically a survey, a voluntary survey, designed to serve the business community. And it all started with someone who visited me before I was even sworn in, someone who many of you know is an advocate at the Capitol, or at least was then, for a veteran service organization. And he basically asked me, why is it that veteran-owned businesses or a veteran who owns a business can't check a box indicating that he or she is a veteran who owns the business and that the business is veteran-owned? It was a good question. I didn't know why. I wasn't sworn in yet. Once I got in, I figured out that there really is no reason why that can't happen. And that morphed into a general survey, very small. We didn't want to survey people to death, 5 questions and 5 alone. It's totally voluntary. No one has to answer any of the questions, or they can answer some of them, about the nature of the business itself. And the 5 questions we got, we reached out to chambers all over the state, to journalists, academics, saying if you could ask any business 5 questions, what are they? You can read for yourself what they are. They're pretty basic. When we first started out, we asked, you know, what kind of response rate do you think we'll get? And those, particularly at St. Cloud State, who we work with, said, well, in survey research, if you're hitting a home run if you can hit 20% response rate. Instead, our current response rate, up from last time I was before you, is 63%. So it's not scientific. It's not absolutely everyone, but a large percentage is responding to this. And you can imagine what the result is. The result is that we have a big database now. that is full of really interesting and valuable information that people can purchase for almost no money. It's like $100 and you can purchase information. So if you wanted to know where your constituents wanted to know, I want to know the names of all veteran-owned businesses in these 8 counties. You can know that. If you wanted to know, I want all the veteran-owned businesses in the financial services sector in these 3 counties. You can know that, and on and on and on, all the permutations and examples. So that's something that we're really excited about, and we hope it really continues to take off in the years to come. This next slide, I got ahead of myself, is what I was talking about. We make about $37 million per biennium, and we cost 22. So we cost 15. So we make $22 million per biennium. That's $11 million per year. Free and clear. So if you take every paperclip, every person, every cost of our office, we actually make money for the state. Next slide. Let's just talk a little bit about elections. That's, of course, what most people think about when they think about our office. And as I said before, you know, we understand why that's true. The office works with counties, cities, and townships in the administration of elections, providing support and training to local elections administrators statewide on the approximately 3,500 elections held year-round. And that's a point I want to emphasize. I think a lot of people think of elections as, well, every 2 years, you got an August primary and a November general election. But that's not the case. As many of you know, particularly from greater Minnesota, elections are going on all the time. There are school board elections. There are township elections in March and November. There are all sorts of special elections. So it's not just even year, couple times a year statewide election. It's pretty well constant among the counties across the state of Minnesota. So voter outreach is a big part of our work as well. So one of the things that we do is we have a disability advisory committee that works on voting issues, as well as the impact legislation may have on members of the disability community. We meet at least quarterly, sometimes more. We also encourage youth civic engagement. This is all nonpartisan. We never tell anyone, obviously, who to vote for or, you know, a party or a cause or anything like that. It's just the nuts and bolts, the rules of the road, how to vote, how to register, et cetera. So we have partnerships with YMCA Youth and Government Program, with groups as varied as 4-H, other youth groups, scouts, colleges and universities, high schools, principals, et cetera. So we run a mock election program called the Students Vote Program in all levels of school up to grade 12. We run something called the Democracy Cup, which enlists colleges and universities, 2-year, 4-year, public, private, doesn't matter, to engage in a competition for voting around Minnesota. That's been very successful as well, and that's the kind of the work we do in that space. As you can see, we partner with all sorts of business and sports communities, whether it's the Vikings or the Saints or the Wild or the Lynx or Blue Cross and Blue Shield or Target, you name it, just getting the word out about ways to vote and the rules of the road. And we also do direct outreach to service members and their families. And we're particularly concerned, whether it's the Red Bulls or anyone else, about deployments and making sure that when people deploy or before they deploy, they have all the resources and the information they need and their families have it as well so that they can vote from wherever they are in the country or in the world. So here are the raw numbers from the last election. They really set a lot of records. Third time in a row is number one in the country. And I'll just draw your attention to the third bullet point, which is really remarkable and represents a change, I assume, somewhat temporary change. We had 58% of those voting this last time that voted before the election. They voted absentee, they voted from home. So that means only 42% voted on game day in the traditional way, in a polling place on the second Tuesday or on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. Whether it'll stay at that rate, who's to say? The rate before in 2018 was 24%. I suspect it'll go down a little bit, but people really like this way of voting. I think that's clear. And Minnesotans really embraced it this last time. And that's why I say, you know, sometimes we're all fixated with talking about election day as the day we vote. That's really not true anymore in Minnesota. And in many places, election day is the last day we vote. It's the last day of a long period of absentee voting. It's the last day, often the biggest day, but it's not the day we vote anymore. Certainly it wasn't this year where a minority of people actually did it that traditional way. Just want to touch quickly on the administration division. That's the office that administers the open appointments process for Minnesota's boards and commissions. We certify official documents, proclamations, extraditions, et cetera. We maintain the original chapter laws. The office and I serve on the Executive Council, the State Board of Investment, and have a non-voting seat on the board of the Minnesota Historical Society. Obviously, we work with state and federal partners as well, as you can see. This is just a glimpse at the open appointments process. It's a lesser known window into a part of state government that we're always trying to spread the word about, which is the opportunity for citizens to serve on any number of over 200, as you see there, about 226 boards and commissions. And a couple of years ago, as some of you know, we revamped the website. It was clunky, it was confusing before, and now it's not. Now it's pretty cool. Click on any board or commission, understand the terms, the expectations, whether there's per diem, whether there are vacancies, if so, when, what the criteria for applying are. You can even see current members and their application materials when they applied to be on the board. So we're proud of that tool in particular. The monthly open positions notice is sent out via email on the first Monday of every month to people who subscribe to receive the notices. And we encourage legislators, if their constituents are interested, to really sign up for these boards and commissions. Again, to make a fine point of it, we don't do the appointing. We run the process, and then the governor, in almost all cases, 99% of the cases, is the governor or the executive branch that actually makes the appointment. So we don't do that, but we set up and we run the intake for all of that. And it's a great opportunity, obviously, to serve. Safe at Home. Many of you are familiar with this. Some maybe not as familiar. It's a life-saving program. Safe at Home is an address anonymity or address confidentiality program that is intended for victims of stalking, domestic violence, sexual assault, or others who fear for their physical safety or the physical safety of family members, typically children. It was enacted by the legislature in 2006. It was up and running by 2007. And basically the way it works is those in the program get to keep their home address totally private and secret for all purposes, not just public, but private. So whether you're working with a retailer or a bank or a school district or for voting, that home address is kept secret and private. Instead, everyone in the program is assigned a PO box, and that PO box can be and is your legal address, including on a driver's license in Minnesota. So it's used for anything you or I would have our use our address for, and it's a protective measure so that those who fear for their safety don't have to worry about their address becoming public and those they fear finding them. So the Safe at Home program receives all participant mail, repackages it, and then forwards it to the participants on a daily basis. We work with partners in 88 social service agencies statewide, and participation, this is sort of bittersweet as you'll learn in a minute, continues to increase from less than 200 in the first year of the program to over 3,000 at the end of last year. The average annual growth rate is about 23% per year. You'll see here just a map of who we work with around the state, including two federally recognized Native American Indian tribes. This is just a quick glimpse about Safe at Home's growth. As you'll see, it's huge and it's bittersweet. On the one hand, it's great that people who really need this extraordinary kind of remedy and service can get this service and put them at ease and their children at ease. On the other hand, how sad is it, let's be honest, that many people and at this rate need that extraordinary service? You don't get to this place unless you're at the worst point in your life. You don't get to a place where you're keeping your address completely secret from everyone, whether it's Target, US Bank, your kid's school. You don't get there until it's so bad that others deem that you need this service. And so that's why I say it's bittersweet. Great that we can provide the service. Really disturbing that many people apparently qualify and need the service. Here you can read for yourselves are some great quotes, just a few of the quotes that we regularly get about people who found it life-changing and even life-saving to be in the program. I'll pivot, Mr. Chair, quickly to our budget. We do have one extraordinary one-time request that we're making of you, of members, and that is a one-time cost for moving. Since 2001, we have been in the Minnesota Retirement System building on Empire Drive, about 8 blocks from the state office building. That's where our business services department is and our infrastructure, IT infrastructure division. But we lost our lease. And that's because the Minnesota State Retirement System is the landlord. They own the building. They built the building in about 2000, 2001, and they inhabit the building and they need the space for themselves. So it's not like we did anything wrong or they found a better tenant. They are the tenant. They're growing and they are expanding into the space that we now occupy. That means we're left to look for space. what you're seeing here, the $500,000, is a best estimate for now based on the Department of Administration. They're the ones who are finding us our new space. We don't have the new space yet. We're supposed to be out by June 30th, although they've given us a grace period of maybe a couple of a few months, maybe towards the fall. So I suspect that as the session goes on, probably in the next few weeks, we'll have an actual space and we'll have more granular, more specific numbers for you. This is an estimate right now based on the cost of moving. Other state agencies and some moving costs that we've had in the past. The next budget item that we have, which is a change item, is, as you can see, the Safe at Home program, as I mentioned, as you saw, continues to grow and grow very quickly. So do the everyday costs like postage, little things like postage. They really, really add up. So as the program grows, there becomes more and more of a need to educate those who may interact with participants. Think about law enforcement, schools, application assistance, et cetera. So we'd like to invest in the program and in the safety of these Minnesotans, and investing an additional $220,000 for the Safe at Home program would do that. So it's not just postage, but it's the supplies, it's training. They're really swamped over there, and they're really stressed, and they're working really hard to do a great service, but they need assistance. Finally, we have a change item having to do with what I mentioned earlier. There's a huge need and a huge demand for services that in the voting education sphere that educate and reach out to young people, not just students, by the way. It's 18 to 24, but more broadly, 18 to 30, really. People are coming to us wanting resources, wanting information, and sometimes it's hard to keep, not sometimes, it's routinely hard to keep up with that demand. So this is a final item there as well. I would just stand for questions at this point, conclude by saying, Mr. Chair, as I always do, we make money for the state. Again, we cost $15 million, we make 37, so we make 22 per biennium. We make a good bit more than we cost. It's not that we make just a little more, we make a lot more. So the fees that we charge, the fees that are set, those are things that go right to the general fund. We don't keep any of that money. And so most of what we do, I would say, the vast majority is required by statute. These aren't sort of freelance things, they're required. And so I'm happy to answer any questions you have about the budget or about the office in general. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. And members, we have 7 minutes left here to ask questions, and I'm getting a big list here. I'm going to go down. I'm going to start with Representative Nash, the lead on the committee. Representative Nash, if you can be short and sweet, and we can get more questions in that way.
Happy to do so, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Simon, I don't know, I think you dialed in after we were talking with the AG, but same question I ask everybody. We're looking at a budget crisis. You mentioned yourself that you recognize that things are going to be tight. I'll ask you this very blunt question. What are you going to do with your base budget or less? Because right now the people of Minnesota are looking at us to find ways to not increase taxes upon them. So that's the question. What are you going to do with less if you have to?
Right. Well, because of the way our office is thank you, Representative Nash and Mr. Chair and members. Because of the way our office is structured, the cuts will not be to stuff. It'll be to people. So any cut would mean things. It would mean layoffs, but it's beyond just layoffs, it's service. So in the past, when we have had to sustain cuts as an office, it's the business community and businesses, that tend to be most directly affected. Long lag times and wait times, and that in effect has a secondary effect on the fees that we collect, less of them. So cutting us is a way, and in the past, this has been provably true, that reduces other amounts that come into the state because we can't generate that extra, that $22 million extra at the same pace. And so it ends up not being 22, it would be something less than 22. So in the end, just historically, based on what's happened historically, if there were a base budget cut, it would mean people, and then that people cut would translate into lagging service times, particularly for the business services. So that would be the probable outcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the interest of brevity, Mr. Secretary, if you would forward on to every member of this committee the details on your $500,000 move fee, that would be greatly appreciated. That's a lot of money, and we're just want to make sure that that we're doing things as inexpensively as possible, but effectively as we can. So, and you and I can talk again later offline, but would encourage you to drag out your paring knife and begin looking at ways to cut back.
Next person is Representative Viskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greetings, Secretary Simon. I appreciate your discussion today, and I even appreciated more the years we spent together in the legislature. And speaking of that, the legislature makes the laws in this state, and I'm deeply concerned about the way this last election was conducted, and that we ended up with some of the election rules being changed in ways that didn't comport with our state laws. Again, the legislature writes the laws to guide the elections, and we had a national activist group called Democracy Docket that went not only to Minnesota, but a variety of states, along with other activist organizations, including the League of Minnesota of Women's Voters in Minnesota, who came to our state, sued us, and then you and the Attorney General were in the position of needing to defend our laws from that lawsuit. And I didn't see a lot of fight in that, Mr. Secretary. But my question is, how do we move on to make certain that we have the laws that the legislature put into place followed in every election in the future? Because we have to do that in order to restore the trust in elections in this state.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Druskowski. Yes, well, let me just say this. I want to get to your actual question, which is a constructive one. We're going to have to agree to disagree on the premise of your question. We can hash that out offline. My duty in a litigation context is to follow the law, period, regardless of my policy preferences, regardless of what policy or ultimate outcome I'd like to see, to follow the law. And as you know, and as every member of the committee knows, the law consists of several things. It's a mix of state statute, federal statute, state constitution, U.S. constitution, and as one that meets the principles outlined in all four sources. So we had to make some judgment calls. Some of them are very tough judgment calls. I stand by those calls. But to your point, Representative Druskowski, I think one thing that I think certainly I could do and our office could do and I will do is to be clear going forward with all of you and all legislators about the litigation landscape, meaning keeping you informed just in general terms. You don't have to see every pleading and every motion filed with the court, but keeping you abreast of what the lawsuits are out there. And by the way, Representative Druskowski, we get sued by all sides. I mean, left, right. Right now, we're battling the Minnesota DFL party in court. We're fighting them in a lawsuit. So we get sued by all sides. And that's okay. That's the way the system's supposed to work. If someone thinks the law ought to change or it's not being administered correctly, that's what you do. You go to court. And then a judge will hash that out. But going forward, our office can keep legislators abreast just generally of, okay, how many lawsuits are in the hopper? At one time, we have 27 active lawsuits at the same time, 27 from all sides of the political spectrum, left groups, right groups, you name it. And we have fewer right now. We still have a lot in the hopper. So going forward, my commitment is to give the legislature a good general understanding, subject to always you, Representative Druskowski, you can always call me or call Sam Bonowitz from our office and get more information. Hey, here's a lawsuit going on. Here's what happens if the lawsuit goes sideways. Here's what happens if the plaintiffs.
Secretary Simon, I have to break in here because it's 10 o'clock and we have a hard stop time at 10 o'clock because of our IT staff. Okay. We have to get ready for the next meeting coming up. And I'm sorry for the members that didn't get their questions asked. If you have questions, you can forward them to the Secretary of State's office. You can forward them to myself or my legislative assistant or the committee assistant, and we can get them to the Secretary's office and get some answers for you. And
with Sam Bonowitz from our office too, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, and Sam Bonowitz, correct. Members, with that, we are adjourned.